I still want mariachi Thriller. Do I have the lyrics somewhere? It's not too late to do that translation.
Es medianoche y algo malo hay en la oscuridad. Bajo la luna besa algo que te hace vomitar. Hay de gritar, pero te proteja todo tu sonido. No te mueves cuando algo te empieza a mirar. Hay de gritar que es un thriller, si lo es. Y nadie va a salvarte de la bestia cerca de ti. Que es un thriller, si lo es. Luchando por tu vida entre esta noche de daño, thriller.
Okay. Greetings, boys and girls. Richout Field here. With a creepifying, is that a word? A scarifying, is that a word? A terrifying creep. A new episode of the Rish Outcast. I'm your host and your friend, Rish Benjamin Outfield, and I am doing a Halloween episode for the greatest day of the year. And this is the second Halloween episode I've done this year. To make a long story short, ah, screw it. I'll make the long story long. So I did an episode about a month back for a story that I wrote in 2019 called The Night Clerk. And this story I think I finished in, I would say, September of 2019, and I thought, wow, I wrote a story that could be used for a Halloween episode, and I'm going to do it. And so I finished it at the cabin, I believe, and driving back from the cabin, I recorded an episode. So that's the previous record was held by Todd Jenny and the Ugly Doll last year, where I finished the story, I sat down to record it, and then the next day, I recorded the episode. This one, I hadn't even sat down to record. I just finished the story, the first draft of the story. And I recorded the episode. And as I did the very first time I did this with the snowstorm story. Stormy weather? There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together. With that episode, I wasn't sure how long the story would be. And so I recorded two outros. One, where I said, okay, that's where we're going to stop for today. Story's too long, but come back next time. We'll get the second half of the story. And another version where I was just like, there you go. The whole story. And I ended up splitting that into two. And I don't know why I don't just always do that. Because if I'm not sure it's a short story, then it's probably long enough I can split into two, right? Boy, I wish I had more listeners, but I will. So to make a long story short, my laptop died, and I was unable to edit without a laptop, and I thought, oh shoot, what am I going to do? There's no way I'm going to make the deadline of Halloween for The Night Clerk. And because I didn't have a laptop and I couldn't edit, I went to the library and I had a work in progress, a story that I had started before The Night Clerk but hadn't finished. And I said, okay, I'm going to finish this. And I did. And when I finished it, it was much, much shorter than the other project, more manageable, if you will. And I chose that story, which is called Touching the Other Side, to be this week's episode. And I hope that you like it. There's not much I can do if you don't like it. But I am going to present it for you now, and then we'll talk on the other side. Let me just go ahead and run it, and then we'll discuss.
Touching the Other Side by Rish Outfield. As the old man made his hesitant way from the audience to the stage, Jamie Iglesias studied him, the way he held himself, his clothing, his haircut, the watch he wore, the ring he did not, even the style of his glasses, all the while listening to the voiceover guy announcing the upcoming personal appearances he'd be making up in New England. He was surprised to hear he'd be doing 2 shows in Connecticut, but smiled patiently as one of the PAs clipped a microphone to the old man's collar. It was the new girl with the huge melons, but the elderly Mark didn't even notice them. That told you something. No, his focus was all on Jamie Iglesias, as he was helped up the steps and over to his side. By the time the stranger got there, he had several observable facts in mind, all ready to go. "Thank you for coming," he said, shaking his hand. The old man was nervous, glancing at the audience, the lights, the cameras, and Iglesias drew him closer, forcing him to focus on him rather than the many, many other people looking on. "Grateful to be here," he said, with just a hint of an accent. Maybe Wisconsin, maybe Minnesota. He had also said grateful to be there instead of happy or eager or excited to be there. That was telling, too. "What is your name, sir?" Iglesias asked, now facing out at the audience again. The old man's already wrinkled brow furrowed a bit. "Don't you know? Who's the psychic here?" Funny. Iglesias nodded, pretended to concentrate, and said, "I think it starts with an L. Something like Lawrence, Leslie, but more like Luke. Am I right?" Disappointment played behind the old man's glasses. "Not even close." "Now, come on, Lucius. I'd say Luke is a pretty similar name, wouldn't you?" Suddenly, relief flooded the stranger, and it showed in his eyeline, his posture, even the way he held his hands.
"Yes, yes, it's Lucius."
Didn't the man remember filling out the card before the taping, with his name, his seat number, and who he wanted to contact? Was it really going to be that easy? Iglesias touched his temple, with the hand not holding the microphone.
"And I am seeing a woman. A woman who is no longer with us."
A nod. But of course it was. You didn't come before a TV psychic to contact somebody that was available on your home speed dial.
"She was very special to you."
He alternated between looking at the mark and facing the crowd and 3 cameras.
"A wife, was it?"
"Yes, yes."
And tears had already started at the corners of Lucius's eyes.
"And she's been gone a long time."
The man started to shake his head. There was only the barest mark where a wedding ring might have sat on his finger. It had seemed likely that...
"No, not long," Iglesias continued. "But it certainly seems long to you, doesn't it?"
"That it does,"
Lucius said, wiping absently at his cheek.
"All right, my friend. Are you ready to touch the other side?"
He sure was. The form the man had filled out had almost no detail to it. Simply that he needed closure with his dead wife, who he hadn't even named. So it took Iglesias a couple of probing statements to get that Lucius was from St. Paul, that he'd lost his wedding ring more than a decade back, and that his dead wife's name was Millie, short for Camille,
rather than Mildred or the medium's first guess, Millicent. He turned his big body to address the studio audience, who was, big surprise, eating this up.
I'm getting an image of Millie in my mind now.
A handsome woman, wasn't she?
Handsome?
Old Lucius asked. And yeah, it was an odd way of putting it. Well, earlier, back when she was younger, I mean. A fine woman, with a roundness to her, a striking smile that lit up every...
Roundness?
The mark repeated. Of course, Millie had been thin, which explained Lucius's lack of appreciation for the new PA's well-displayed rolling hills.
A roundness in her eyes, I mean. How they twinkled, even before she smiled.
He almost had the old guy back.
Yes, that's Millie, all right.
Maybe one more description, since the letters and emails constantly said that they loved that part the most. The amazing details.
Not a big woman, was she? Svelte, no?
Does that mean thin?
In her case, yes. Quite thin.
As a rail,
the old man said, and nearly everybody in the crowd laughed at that. He could feel their excitement, the electricity in the air, the way they were eating this up. It was almost a psychic thing, wasn't it?
But it worked for her, Iglesias continued. And I'm sensing that she had short hair, maybe cut in a...
The man frowned, the line on his forehead growing back.
No, she had long hair, hardly ever cut it.
Okay, Iglesias said, trying to see her once again.
But did she ever put it up? In a bun, a top knot, maybe braids?
She did do braids when we first met, but...
That's it, then. Braids.
But I didn't like them,
the old man finished. Iglesias nodded.
She tells me she's sorry about that, about having her hair in braids now, but it's easier to manage that way.
The old man accepted that.
Can you tell her I miss her?
Oh, she knows that, Lucius, my friend. And she misses you. In fact, it's almost overwhelming. The love and affection I'm receiving from her, obviously directed at you.
It was then that the old man began to break down, his lower lip quivering, his eyes filling with tears, all there in front of two cameras from two different angles, and a higher one on a crane that took in the whole section of the stage where he was standing, and the people on the front rows who were becoming emotional around him. They hadn't been seated there by accident. And while the show was taped on Wednesdays and shown on Saturdays, many, many more people would weep and feel the joyous reunion between the unsteady old man and his apparently trophy wife, Millie.
Oh, that's such a relief,
Lucius said.
Jamie, I was so afraid she had fallen out of love with me when she... You know, when she...
When she crossed over, the psychic finished for him.
Oh, you don't need to worry. She loved you, loves you, more than you ever knew. In fact, it's warming my heart to see her there, looking at you, sending out such positive vibes your way.
Warms my heart, too,
the old man said, and began to tremble. Iglesias considered going on, giving more detail, more messages from this man's dead Millie, but paused instead and found the camera with its light on, camera 2. He peered into it reverently.
This is a special moment here, between a parted husband and wife, and I think we'll go to commercial now, so the reunion can be a little more private. But if you'd like to be in the audience at one of our shows, just go to our website at www.touchingtheotherside.com and order a ticket. Or better, I may be coming to your town on my spiritual tour and campaign. We can pierce that misty veil together. New dates are being added all the time. Just check at that website or call the number on your screen. We'll be right back after some important messages. Thank you. He stood still, smiling at the camera, until the red light went off, and the voice of his producer said,
"And we're out."
Jamie Iglesias took a deep breath, slouching a bit more in his cream-colored suit now that they'd stopped recording. He looked down at the old man, who was trying to make it back to his seat. "What's your last name, Lucius?"
"Me? Spindler,"
the mark managed, but he was pretty overrun by emotion. The couple next to him, who probably didn't even know the guy, was trying to comfort him. But he didn't need comforting. He was happier than he'd been all day. Anyone could see that. Happier than he'd been in a year.
"Mr. Spindler."
It was a ridiculous last name, but the psychic didn't let that shake his solemn conviction.
"Your wife has seen you these past months, and she wants you to be strong, and she is listening. Go ahead and tell her what's on your mind."
He said a few words, some personal things, and Iglesias was glad they'd stopped the taping for a few minutes. He'd reset, and they'd finish up the show for the afternoon.
"Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a nice round of applause for our friend Mr. Spindler."
The applause was genuine and generous. Still with the microphone to his chin, Iglesias said,
"Lucius, thank you for this connection you've made. Now someone will get you a waiver to sign, and I'm going to get a drink of water. Then we'll continue the show."
The audience applauded again, this time unbidden. The episode was going to be a viewer favorite. Iglesias saw a bouquet of flowers in a vase just inside his dressing room and didn't bother reading the card. Instead, he opened one of the water bottles chilling on the desk and drank half of it in a single gulp. He winced as the cold gave him a brain freeze and glanced at himself in the big mirror. His makeup was running, and at a sweaty temple, he thought he spied another gray hair. He'd have Donetta go through it next week, plucking any that she found. He took a step toward the bathroom when his cell phone, plugged into its charging port, began to ring. Iglesias frowned and glanced at it. It was Pamela, who should have known better than to call him at this hour, on a taping night, no less. He let the voicemail get it. His job was hard, exhausting even, and he deserved a break, at least for an hour or so. But the phone rang again, the same number, and he gritted his teeth and answered it.
"It's Pam,"
his agent said, unnecessarily. He was a psychic, after all. "Yes?"
"I got an offer."
"Show went fine, Pamela. Thanks for asking."
Iglesias called his agent Pamela when he was displeased, because she didn't like the sound of it. That meant he only called her Pam about half the time.
"Glad to hear it, James,"
she said. His name was not James, but it was actually Arliss. His legal first name was Jamie. But Pam had once told him he looked like a James, and had called him that ever since. Seeing as she had been there from the beginning of his career, he didn't begrudge her that.
"I just got an offer for you to do a gig in Idaho this summer,"
he interrupted her. She never seemed to mind, now that her weekly cut of his earnings listed in the thousands.
"I don't go to Idaho, or any of those sorts of place,"
she interrupted him back.
"This one's worth your while."
"And please don't call it a gig, Pamela. I'm a medium, not a garage band."
Well, this particular battle of the bands would be for July. 2nd of July, looks like.
Battle of the bands? Iglesias asked. What do you mean, battle of...
A joke. Never mind.
Iglesias shook his head. Not that she could see him. July 2nd's too close to the 4th. I usually do family things on the 4th.
Uh-huh.
She said again, which meant she was ignoring the lie he had just told.
Should I tell them no, or do you want to know how much?
He said, sure. Then, almost immediately, never mind. I'm not interested. I went to Ohio once when I was a boy. Nearly died of boredom.
This is Idaho, sir.
That's what I meant. I don't like Idaho, Pamela, he said, opening a second bottled water. Too many white people in one place just isn't natural. Her tone was not amused.
You got no problem going to Vermont, James. That's whiter than Wonder Bread.
But it's not Idaho, Pamela.
Do you want to know the number or not?
She sounded testy. She was one of the few people that still dared talk down to him. But she had known him way back when, before this whole medium mentalist thing had started, when he was just a phlebotomist and part-time motivational speaker. Is it enough to merit flying to Boise?
I'd say so,
the agent said.
And it's a little town an hour from Boise.
Iglesias made a disgusted sound. Then he said, how much? She told him. It was enough to make the young phlebotomist Jamie Iglesias, nay Arliss Sanders, burst into uncontrollable tears.
And the weird thing is, they sent a check for $5,000, whether you accept it or not.
That was not a retainer then, but technically counted as a donation. He nodded, not that she could see him. Is Idaho hot in July?
Everywhere's hot in July, sir.
He gritted his teeth. Thanks, but no thanks, Pam. God bless. And he hung up. But an hour later, the phone rang again. He checked the caller, considered ignoring it, but he had hired her for a reason. Pamela, I just put a quiche on.
Sounds delish. No sooner had I declined the Idaho thing than a new offer came in. $1,000 more.
$1,000? He almost laughed. I sign a book for that.
They said you only have to do the oration, no Q&A.
Uh-huh. He was not impressed. The agent went on.
But for the full appearance, with reading and questions, they offered an extra 10.
He was suspicious. Well, he always had been, but now he was really suspicious. 10,000.
On top of their previous, rather impressive, offer.
Christ, Iglesias muttered.
What was that, James?
She asked, and he thought he detected a laugh there. Just a prayer, Pam, to give me strength to go to Iowa.
Idaho, sir.
Right, Idaho. Okay, book it. But send them my regular rider, and they have to agree to everything.
Oh,
she said.
What? They booked you into a bed and breakfast.
What? When?
The 1st, the night before.
So? I only stay in suites. And even then, I...
This was their insistence. Apparently the local hotel is booked for the 4th.
Then find another hotel. There's got to be...
It was their one demand,
she interrupted, sounding apologetic. And she ought to be. Demand. He said it like some would say pedophile, or meth addict, or cockroach, or Democrat.
Request,
Pam amended. Their one request. besides going to Ohio and picking the date. That time he'd gotten the state name wrong on purpose. He knew it was Iowa, but she didn't correct him on it. Maybe she was psychic, too.
It sounded quaint, the way they described it.
That word. It was worse than cockroach. Who? Who described it?
The emails.
Emails from whom? He was raising his voice now. She paused, checking.
Mr. Manny Geist? I can forward you the email.
Politely decline, he said. Tell them you can book me a hotel, and they can send a car to get me to the venue.
If you're sure...
she began, then stopped. Pam.
Okay, they've sent another email.
Canceling, I hope. The money had sure been tempting, but only certain types of people stayed at bed and breakfasts, and he was not among them. She made a surprised sound.
It's a wire transfer of $10,000 to save the date.
Ten, he muttered, starting to grind his teeth. She waited politely. Iglesias indulged the teeth-grinding habit for a while. He was upset about all this, and vowed to blame his agent for talking him into it, if anything went less than swimmingly. But he gave her the go-ahead to agree to their terms. Sure, he'd be there, in July, at their charming little bed and breakfast. As long as the money transfer went through all right. There weren't any problems with the flight, and the shuttle that took him to the tiny, historic town of Vernon was already paid for. The driver, who barely looked old enough to sit behind the wheel, seemed to be expecting a tip, but Iglesias ignored him. He got out and looked at the big two-story building. It was ugly, even by Midwestern standards. It looked Depression-era, but half of it was a new extension, which barely matched the architecture of the rest of the manor house. Hell, the windows weren't even the same shape from section to section. He figured its usual clientele wasn't that picky, just eager to get indoors, get in bed, and get undressed. There was no one to greet him at the door or help him in with his hefty luggage. Strike two, the first being the ghastly uneven architecture. And as he made his way inside, he got a deep whiff of lemon pledge. Normally the smell was slightly pleasing to him, but he chose to let it bother him now. The lobby was tastefully decorated, but gave the impression of having been robbed recently, and everything there now being a hasty replacement. The floor was lined with rugs, six that he could see, each with a different bird on it. It was overkill, probably a surplus sale or a drunken purchase. There was a young couple on the couch, chatting quietly, and sitting just far enough away from each other that they didn't touch. They didn't look up as he walked by, and you didn't have to be a psychic to know that they were newly married or engaged, and having their first, or one of their first, fights. The main reception desk was decorated with carnations, but by their configuration, they were probably phony. There was a skinny, bookish-looking young man behind the desk who nodded at Iglesias, seemingly without recognition, as he approached. Iglesias set his suitcase down, marveling that it could weigh so much with so little inside. Perhaps Donetta had slipped a cinder block or two in there before zipping it closed. "Good evening," said the kid. The expression on his face seemed giddy, maybe even goofy. What was he so excited about, if it wasn't the arrival of a television celebrity?
"Evening,"
Iglesias said back. The clerk's eyes went to an obviously not antique grandfather clock, sitting beside a legitimately vintage fireplace, pretty much useless in July.
"Yep, sure is."
Perhaps it was nearing the end of his shift.
Maybe he was just an imbecile. Iglesias disliked the kid immediately, but reserved the right to outright despise him if given an excuse. The clerk's name tag said Mason on it. The kid gave him a smile, but Iglesias didn't trust it. There was a word for that kind of gesture. Perfunctory, that's what it was. Checking in. A nod. Name? Jamie Iglesias. Mason didn't blink. Do you have a reservation? We're pretty booked up tonight. Don't you know who I am? Iglesias asked. Tens of millions of households got his cable channel. But this kid probably only watched the ones with Japanese animation and filthy cartoons made for teenagers. The set of the clerk's jaw changed. You said it was James Iglesias? Jamie Iglesias. You don't know the name. Mason considered, as if deciding the best way to answer. Instead, he pressed a couple of keys on his computer behind the desk. Oh, okay. Something passed over the kid's face as he read something on the screen, and it went from goofy to merely dorky. Clearly, the clerk now knew who he was dealing with. Would he change his tune? Become solemn and respectful? Was there some scripted welcome he had been instructed to give? Would he now pretend to be a fan of the show, maybe even ask for an autograph or a reading? But no, the kid merely said, Yes, I see you now. And you're all set. Thank you. You'll be in room number 5. That pause meant something. What is the problem? No problem, mister. Everything is paid for and ready for you. Then why all the hesitation? Are you stoned, young man? The goofy smile broadened. No, sir, I'm just under-caffeinated. He handed over the key, still chatting. The other night shift clerk hasn't come in yet, and I haven't had a chance to... Iglesias raised his hand, trying to shut Goofy up. You've worn that shirt 2 days in a row. You've just got a haircut. You ate a submarine sandwich for lunch today. And you're thinking about buying a new pair of shoes. The kid blinked, processing what he'd just been told, and some of the smile faded. Excuse me? The psychic did another quick once-over, picking up 3 or 4 more probabilities and one more definite observation. When you left home this morning, Mason, you... And then the clerk's head turned as someone came into the lobby and around the desk, typing something into the computer. She was slender and attractive, and wearing a button-up blouse that seemed to have shrunk 3 sizes in the wash, or been designed that way, one of the buttons threatening to pop off and blind someone. Mason the clerk had forgotten all about his guest and only had eyes for her.
Mason, she said.
Purred, practically.
Hey,
he stammered, his nostrils flaring. Iglesias didn't need any psychic abilities to guarantee the kid's heart rate had just doubled in speed. So that's what he'd been watching the clock about.
Coming in late again?
Goofy remarked, goofily. The pretty clerk snorted.
10 minutes early. I'm going to hit the bathroom, all right?
Before the kid could declare anything she might do was more than all right, Iglesias cleared his throat. Both desk clerks looked toward him, maybe surprised he was still there. He scowled and gestured to his enormous suitcase. Will you have someone get my bag? He said it as though it were the 3rd time he was asking. The mail clerk, whose skinny arms looked gangly coming out of his button-up shirt, noticed the case, practically a trunk, and swallowed before saying, Of course, I can get that for you, sir. He came around the desk and hefted the case as best he could.
Just follow me.
Iglesias inwardly scoffed at the gangly goof's struggle, then followed him to the room.
Mason paused outside the door, waiting for the man to open it.
"Just coming from Fort Knox, I see," the kid said.
"Beg pardon."
"I was figuring the suitcase has gold bars in it."
Iglesias nodded. "Ah, iron bars. Easy mistake."
Goofy laughed, and it sounded genuine enough.
They went inside, and Iglesias thanked him and ushered him out. If everything was paid for, then that meant his tip was already taken care of, didn't it? Once alone, the psychic pondered his situation. There had been no recognition in the goofy clerk's eyes, and the sexy one hadn't even glanced at him. If there was anything worse than celebrity, it was anonymity. Maybe they didn't even get cable out here in Yeehaw, Idaho. There was nothing on the dresser waiting for him. He'd expected flowers or fruit or at least a welcoming letter, but there was nothing. Not even a balloon or homemade sign. Whoever had known he was coming, with something other than indifference, had not yet shown their face. The room was old-fashioned, understated, with nothing flashy. Even the television was in a cabinet, so as not to offend any guests over a century old. It was quaint in its way. Iglesias had always loathed that word. He sat on the bed and untied his shoes. Mason, the clerk, meanwhile, went back to the reception desk. He looked around for Natalie, who had not yet come out, then went to the phone and dialed a number.
Charlie, it's Mason.
He shook his head, as though the business manager could see it.
No, no, don't come back. You know the mystery fund? Well, I just checked in a guest. His room was paid for already, by the fund. More than 1,000 of it has been transferred out.
He checked something on the computer.
No, I don't think so. An a-hole, for sure, but not a criminal type.
He chuckled.
No, I've never lived anywhere else. But I watch movies.
He glanced over at the young couple getting up from the sofa across from reception. It looked like they were finally heading up to their room. Nope. She was going to the restrooms, and he was headed to the parking lot. A pity.
You sure you gotta go? You could come talk to him,
he asked into the phone.
Oh, okay. I understand. Yeah, it is kind of scary when you put it that way. I'll let you know if anything else happens.
He hung up and snuck back to the break room for an energy drink, or a chance to talk to Natalie. Or, if he was lucky, both. Jamie Iglesias took his shoes off and loosened his belt. He glanced over the corners of the bedroom, checking to see if there was a minibar. No luck. He stepped into the bathroom, expecting a cheap, probably leaky, shower, but found a big porcelain bathtub, one long enough for two people, so he'd fit in it fine. Sometimes he liked to get in a scalding bath and just sit there thinking until it turned cold, but only if it was really, really hot. Out of curiosity, he turned on the tap. Nothing happened for a moment, and then water blasted out of the nozzle with a loud, practical sonic boom. He jumped, letting out an undignified cry. He glowered and turned the water back off, not even testing the temperature of the hot. Maybe he'd piss in the bathtub later, right before he left. Maybe do more than piss if he could manage. He left the bathroom, embarrassed at being startled, even if no one would ever know about it. As he stepped back into the bedroom, he thought he heard a knock, probably at the door, although it could have been on the wall, or even the ceiling. He paused, waiting. But it was something else, he supposed. He checked his phone. 2 messages, and glanced around for a place to charge it. One of the texts was from his asset director. 2 checks unreceived. 20K? Iglesias didn't feel like responding tonight. He checked his other message. The second text was one word. Fraud. He looked at the sender. It said, unknown. Great. He deleted it. As he was setting down the phone, another text came through. He looked at his screen. Liar. Same sender, no doubt. He didn't delete this one, but just hit block sender and put it out of his head. You didn't get to his level without weathering the occasional hostility. The overloud noise came again from the bathtub as the water started up anew. He stepped into the bathroom again, his brow furrowed. The water was on, both the hot and the cold. He noticed the stopper in the plug. Had it been there before? He turned off the water and observed the stiffness of the knobs. Doubtful they could have turned on their own. But water pressure building up. Regardless, he looked around, in case there was another entrance to the room. Old place like this could have secret passages and Norman Bates spy holes. Not that anything in Idaho could be old. He'd passed the Vernon Park on the way up, and next to a dubiously sexy statue of an Indian, noticed that they'd barely celebrated their centennial. The bathroom walls were tile and wood paneling. Not very easy to hide a door in. But if someone were playing a prank, he was the right guy for it. A psychic not knowing he was being watched? Being, what was that idiot word kids used nowadays? Punked out? It was exactly the sort of thing flyover state bumpkins might do to entertain themselves. His phone buzzed again in his pocket. Liar, huh? He said to the room. That didn't bother him. Everybody lied, all the time. The worst thing, he figured, he'd ever been called over the years was a Jewish bastard. Because he was not Jewish, and his parents had been legally wed. Names didn't bother him. He'd been called a cheat and a fraud from the very beginning of his career, since before he was touching the other side's Jamie Iglesias, TV psychic. Once, a man had stomped up to him as he was being seated at a restaurant. The dude, surprisingly strong, had grabbed his first two fingers in his fist and growled, "Tell me all my secrets, you spite!" Iglesias had never identified the last word the dude had said, whether it was sprite or shite or kike, again, not Jewish, or maybe some name that meant something to him, not to psychics. Iglesias had winced in pain, thought quickly, and said, "You have a temper. You work with your hands. You smoke unfiltered cigarettes. You like beer, okay. Wine, not so much. You didn't enjoy school, especially high school. College? That's a joke. You're divorced, but better off for it. Your luck's about to change. Sports? Gambling? Lottery? Maybe..." And the dude had let go of Iglesias' fingers, his eyes widening. "I used to play bunco and keno at the VA hall." Iglesias had tried to keep any fear and discomfort out of his voice, as though he hadn't just been assaulted, as though he was talking to a friend. "I envy you and the good turn your luck is having." A nod, the dude's eyes shining. "What else?" Iglesias squinted, channeling all his extra mental facilities. "You have a truck? Someone's near it." The dude squinted back. "Near my truck? They mean it harm. Just a kid doesn't even know you." "My truck?" The guy was near to panic now. "I believe it's yours. Can't see it clearly. It's red or black. I..." "Red!" exclaimed the dude. "Yeah, that's my 4x4. Of course it was red. Go. They haven't done anything to it yet, but they're gathering their courage. The dude was practically frantic. Stay here, he said, and headed for the exit. Come right back, Iglesias called, almost adding, I have so much to tell you. He was unstintingly helpful, even to violent thugs in restaurants. He forgot about his meal and casually left through the side door, scanning the lot for gaudy red trucks. He had ambled to his car and drove away, deciding to avoid that restaurant for a while, which turned out to be permanent. Observation was 90% of medium work. The last 9% was giving the mark options. Your father was big, but shorter than he seemed. You rarely got along, but you sure were special to him. It made him his living and had saved his fingers, if not his life. The other 1% was just getting lucky with guesses. But never resort to guessing until after you'd blown their minds with options and restating the obvious. A knock came on the door to room 5. It was definitely someone there, knocking steadily 4 or 5 times. Maybe the goofy clerk offering to take his breakfast order, hoping against hope for a gratuity. Iglesias strode over, already getting ready to shout, and wrenched the door open. No one was there. For a moment, he hesitated before stepping into the hall, as if he was afraid of what might be waiting there. Stupid. He immediately stuck his head out, preparing to catch a kid in the act, or duck back in if it was a crazy person or someone offended by his line of work. Fraud. But no one was in the hall, up or down. He grumbled and went back into the room. He locked the door behind him. He could imagine a number of ways someone could knock and not be caught doing it. A mechanism, a pole from upstairs or downstairs, something thrown against the door and then reeled into another room with a fishing line, a recording of a knock. Or easiest, knocking and then running into an adjoining room. He waited for them to knock again. Pranksters could never rest after just one, or two in this case. But how would he catch them if the door was locked? He stepped over, putting his hand on the deadbolt, ready to turn it if... But no knocks came. He looked around the room and noticed the curtains were pulled open. People could be watching him right now, highly entertained. He crossed to close them. Again? Had they been drawn when he first came into the room? And forced himself to stop grinding his teeth. His cell phone buzzed on the bed. When had he set it there? As he picked it up, he could hear the water running in the bathroom again. Jamie Iglesias rushed into the bathroom, turned off the tap. Just the cold had been running this time. They were slipping. And switched on his phone. The caller was no longer unknown. This time, it said, Mom. The text he'd received consisted of, Tell me all my secrets, you spite. His dead mother had sent the text, apparently. Really scary, he said, as sarcastically as possible for whoever was listening, because they definitely were. Probably had hidden cameras set up, too. Well, let them laugh and illegally tape him. He'd end up owning this place before the night was over. He deleted the text, then regretted it since Mom could text him again before he could block her. Why didn't he just turn off his phone? Because then they would win, he decided. They knew who he was and couldn't help messing with him and hoped that he would react badly. They wouldn't win. He'd grab his bag and head down to the desk and demand Goofy or the flirty clerk with the pointy tits put him in another room. Or he could just leave, go up the road and find a motel where he would be left alone. but then they would win, he reminded himself through gritted teeth. So he'd demand another room and threaten to back out of tomorrow's appearance if the interruptions didn't stop. He'd claim to know exactly who was behind it, and that the money meant nothing to him, only his self-respect. The knock came again, practically a pounding this time. The psychic shook his head. "Not even checking, assheads," he announced. But he stepped out of the bathroom anyway. The knocking continued. Lots of it. Multiple fists, maybe a dozen hands, scratching, banging, all across the door. Iglesias suddenly became unsettled. He was grinding his teeth again. As he stood there, between the bed and the door, he felt the room temperature drop, substantially, as though a freezer door had been opened behind him. He checked the window. It wasn't open. But the curtains were. That would be easy enough to pull off. This all would. But his hindbrain was telling him something was wrong here. Something truly, dangerously unright. He tried to dismiss the feeling. If anything, the fact that they had spooked him, even a little, made him angrier, more determined to stick it out than before. "Who is it?" he called, pretending to be welcoming. He was just expecting room service or a guest. The knocking stopped. The lock on the door began to turn by itself. The phone at his side started to buzz. The doorknob turned. It was Alaska cold in here now. A click broke the silence. The door to the room slowly opened. Ghosts stood in the doorway. He knew they were ghosts because some were not solid. Some were in the process of becoming skeletons. Some were missing parts. One was burned beyond recognition, not identifiable as man or woman, except for the remnants of a dentist's smock. One was in a wedding dress, her skin so pale it matched the outfit exactly. One was a child of 3 or 4, his brains protruding from a seam in his head. A man with a noose around his neck floated a few inches off the floor. They came into the room, all at once. One passed through the doorframe directly.
"Harless?"
a voice spoke behind him. He turned, slowly, faintly aware he had pissed in his pants. He hadn't even had to go. His mother was standing beside the bathtub, turning the water on again.
"Harless, I'm so disappointed in you," she whispered,
and he recognized that tone, that sad but also angry tone from 4 decades back. His mother had rotted some since she'd been buried, and the blue dress she'd worn in the coffin was now gray. Her eyes were gray, too, devoid of color, perhaps rolled back in her head, perhaps just milky with decomposition. But it was definitely Mom.
"You've deceived so many people, Arliss. I'm ashamed to know you."
"I give people hope, Ma," he tried to say, his instant go-to answer to accusations, but all that came out were wheezes. Ghosts were real. He was standing among them right now, and they were closing in on him.
"You've told so many lies,"
his dead mother continued.
"Even the name of your program is a lie, Arliss."
He could feel the ghosts grabbing him then. They were solid, able to grip him, able to lift him, able to move him toward the bathtub, which now had 1 or 2 inches of frigid water in it.
"We're here to help you, Arliss,"
a dead man beside him hissed. He was green from carbon monoxide poisoning. It was Scotty Cartson, the man who died in his building as a boy, the first dead body he'd ever smelled. The hands grasped his arms and legs tightly and toppled him into the tub. Cold. So cold.
We want you to touch the other side,
Mr. Cartson said. And his mother said, and his doctor said, and a dozen strangers said, all dead, all alive again, all real. Some of them laughed, as Arla Sanders, as psychic Jamie Iglesias, choked and spluttered at the little water at the bottom of the tub. His mother, however, cried as he drowned. They didn't find Iglesias until the next afternoon. There never had been any appearance or seminar, so no one involved in the Better Breakfast knew who he was or why he was there. They'd never seen his show. But the dead had. They couldn't know that the spirits had financed this particular trip and booking, tired of his shtick, his lies and cheap parlor tricks, and doling out their own brand of justice. The staff found him in the bathroom, still head first in the big tub, one of his hands still splayed. His door had been ajar, but not open. Mason Bradley, who identified the body, assumed a lot of the bathwater had drained out of the tub. But no, you actually can drown in 1 inch of water, as long as someone, or many someones, hold you down. The end.
All right. That was touching, wasn't it? Touching the other side. I am happy to have shared that story with you. If you want to listen to the outtakes, there's a much longer explanation of why this episode became our Halloween episode. And the episode that I recorded a month ago, not even a month for this Halloween, will have to be next year's Halloween episode. Unless I die. The Christmas episode that you'll get this year, 2019, was recorded last year, 2018, because when I got home and started to think about editing it, I thought, oh no, that story needs a rewrite, and it still does. And then I have to record it, and then I have to edit it, and then I have to edit the episode. There's no way I'm going to manage in time. So 2018's Christmas episode became 2019's Christmas episode. Ditto with the Halloween episode. So touching the other side, I chose not to tell you that it is another story in the Dead and Breakfast series about the bed and breakfast in Idaho that is predictably haunted every year on the same night. I did an episode called True Ghost Encounter. That was the first story that I wrote in this setting, explaining the premise. And at the time, I had a couple of ideas for other stories. I tried to put some colorful characters in the lobby that were also there that night that somebody could write a story about. And then I had in the back of my mind an idea. I was going to write a story about what happens to the owner of the bed and breakfast on that night. That story is yet to be written because I had kind of intended that to close out the anthology. In my mind, I wanted other people to write stories based on this premise of somebody coming to the bed and breakfast and, you know, who knocks at their door. And what happens, and whoever it's about, they, you know, they could make up somebody, they could have somebody that goes there because they know it's haunted, they could have somebody go there quite by accident. And I came up with an idea of, what about the clerk that works the night desk on the evening that the hauntings occur? What happens to them? Do they get visited by a ghost or not? How do they act? How do they respond when these other people have experienced these things that are thrilling or romantic or touching, cathartic, or terrifying? That was an idea that I had, and I had forgotten that I had had it, because that's what The Night Clerk is about. Natalie Whitmore, the character that The Night Clerk is about, appears in this story very, very fleetingly. She's got like two lines. The psychic mostly interacts with Mason, who is, I think I called him Mason Bradley in this. I gave him a last name in this story. But he is also a big character in The Night Clerk. I'll tell you what, I'll put The Night Clerk out as a, you know, a text file you can buy for a couple bucks if you're interested. Or you can wait a year and you'll hear it on this show. Okay, so last April there was a Comic-Con, and my cousin has a minivan. He's got three kids, so he's got a minivan. And whenever we go to this Comic-Con with kids, he drives in the minivan. And one of the days, or maybe two of the days, my niece, who is now 18, she used to be the little girl that did the Creative Commons license.
Apparently the creative in Creative Commons doesn't mean anything.
She's a teenager now, or a grown woman, if you want to say that. I certainly wasn't a grown woman when I was 18. She was asking me about what I had been writing, and she said, did you ever write that story about the haunted hotel? And I said, oh, I did, actually. I had told her about it when she was 15 or 14 or something. And I said, you know, and I had another idea. Let me run it by you and see if you like it. There's one of those TV psychics, not like Miss Cleo, but like one of those guys, John Edwards types, that is a charlatan, that just guesses, that makes observations and blows people's minds. But when you watch it as a skeptic, you're like, whoa. He said it was either a mother, a sister, a grandmother. And the guy in the audience said, my aunt? And he goes, yes, yes, that's it. He didn't even guess that, you know, that kind of thing. But to the person in the chair, these revelations, these psychic flashes are mind-blowing and totally convincing. I said, okay, so there's one of these guys. And he stays at the bed and breakfast. He knows that there's no such thing as ghosts, but he makes a living pretending that he can communicate with ghosts, that he sees ghosts all the time. And here's the clincher. The ghosts booked this appointment for him. They booked the hotel. They got him out there on the one night that they would have power to get their revenge. And my niece, her eyes went wide, and she's like, oh, that's great. You've got to write that. And honestly, just having a person say, oh, that's great, you've got to write that, is what I need a lot of times. I have so many different ideas for stories, but I don't write them all. I don't come even close to writing them all. And so many fall by the wayside because I don't have enough interest, because I'm not professional enough to say, you know, I had this idea, it's a good one, I'm going to write it. And then sometimes doubt creeps in too. And I go, oh, I don't know if it's a good idea. And having my niece show that kind of enthusiasm, it was like, okay, I'm going to put a gold star by this idea. I did start writing it probably April, but it might have been May. You know, I have stories that I have started 15 years ago that I might finish. But this one, you know, was just written. It might even have been in the summertime. So that's not such a long time to wait. I did lose some of that writing from that first night. I couldn't find it anywhere. Usually I will write these ideas for stories in the body of an email and then just save it in drafts. Because that way, whether I'm on my phone or I'm at the library or at home or on a laptop, I can just access that anywhere. Big does the same thing with Google Docs. That sort of thing is not my bag, baby. As I am wont to do, I worked on it for a little while and then just let it go. Moved on to other projects. I don't know why I do that. I wish that I didn't. Something will jump in my head and I'll be like, oh, that's what I'm going to write now. And I think part of it is because I write for myself. I don't have a publisher. I don't have a deadline. I don't have people that I answer to. And so I find it really hard to focus. I got it into my head. I thought it would be really fun to write a story in this series about somebody that gets hired to work the night desk at that bed and breakfast. And what is their policy? What do they tell the employees right off? This place is haunted. And I came up with this premise, the overall premise of a old faithful of haunted houses, meaning that it is haunted in a predictable, timely fashion. But it could also be haunted any number of other days during the year leading up to this one day when it's guaranteed to be haunted. Does that make sense? In some ways, when I came up with the concept, it was like a TV show, like a Love Boat kind of show, where other people could come on board and write, no pun intended with the come on board, and write their own stories, but I needed the rules set down beforehand so that everybody was on the same page. But because nobody else has written any stories in this series, I've never really had to do that, and I've never really had to answer any questions from other people. So if somebody wrote a story about one of the housekeeping staff members that got hired without knowing that it was haunted, and she finds out the hard way, that's an interesting story. But if another person wanted to write a story about a housekeeping staff member who comes to work there because she heard that it was haunted and she wants to work at a place with ghosts, that is also an interesting story. I don't know. I guess I would have to create rules. But the night clerk story that I wrote gives us a few more of these rules. And I think fills in a little bit more of the detail of how the place works. And I almost said why, but no, I'm not ever going to. Well, somebody else could come along and write a why story. Now in the back of my mind, I'm sort of coming up with a why. Whoops. Anyhow, I wrote Night Clerk all the way through to the end. And that was going to be my episode for Halloween this year, but it's just too big, and I wouldn't be able to edit something that extensive because my laptop died. And so during that time that my laptop died, I had to do other things. I wish that I had chosen to do Tales of eBay Horror videos, but I didn't. I chose to pick up this story that I had started before about the psychic. Actually, I went to a book signing, and it started at 6 p.m. and was scheduled to go to 8 p.m. So there was, you know, a two-hour stretch. There was a Q&A for about an hour, hour and 15 minutes, and then the book signing started, and I realized that I was going to be there for a good long time. Everybody had numbers, and the signing was taking forever, and so I went out to my car and I grabbed a notebook and I brought it to write in the line, and I ended up writing this story all the way to the end. Even though the signing went till 8 o'clock, people were still in line for the signing at 10 o'clock when the bookstore closed. And I got out of there at like 10:40, 10:45. So that tells you just how long I was standing in the line. But I feel like I've made great use of it. And because we had numbers, instead of just being in a line, I was able to go sit down and write. And every once in a while I would get up and I would check to see what number they had gotten to. And so I wrote two of these stories, these Dead and Breakfast anthology stories, in a year, or in a, you know, 5-month stretch kind of thing. And I'm proud of that. Whether you like the story or not, it's always good to have another story written and out there. And who knows, this story or the next one or the one after that might be the one where somebody reads it and goes, oh, I've got an idea. And they contact me and write a story set in this universe. And then that would be really interesting to run on the show, if the person that wrote the story would let me. We'll see if that ever happens. I'm not going to count my chickens before they hatch on that. All I know is now I have three stories set, I was going to say set in this universe, but that's a lofty expression, and I'm not anywhere near that lofty. But I have three stories, and right now I don't have any ideas for a fourth one, except for when I said somebody's going to write about why it is haunted. I thought about like somebody coming to investigate, a paranormal investigator or something like that, that does the research and tries to figure out why, and why this particular day, and how long has this been going on. You never know. As far as this one goes, I had intended for the character of Jaime Iglesias, the protagonist essentially, to be a really, really nasty, terrible person. I had this idea of what kind of person would make their living tricking people out of their money by pretending to contact their dead loved ones. I remember South Park did an episode about John Edwards. I can't remember what it was called, but it was something like the biggest douche in the universe. You know, the South Park guys felt like somebody that does this is the scum of the earth. And that's not to say that I disagree with them, but Jaime Iglesias, this guy, I guess just because he was the protagonist of the story, I sympathized with him a little bit. And I ended up writing him not quite as nastily as I intended to before. I had had this idea that he was like a religious leader in a way. There's that line about the money that they sent wasn't a reservation, it was a donation. And that came from when he was going to be a religious charlatan. You know, the power of Jesus allows me to touch the other side. And those people really, truly are the scum of the earth. Those are just abhorrent people. And I couldn't write a story about them, about that kind of person. I didn't. I was going to have him be like super religious, and he was quoting the Bible, and he's got a wife and, you know, like four kids, but he's always screwing around, and he uses his gift, if you will, as a chance to not only bilk people out of their money, but bilk women out of their clothes. And I was going to have him be a huge hypocrite. And as Matt and Trey said, a giant douche. But I'm not sure I'm ready for that story, a story of a character like that yet. There's a Ben Parks story that I've started and stopped a bunch of times where he goes and helps a minister or a pastor and
because Ben was raised by nuns and priests, he has a lot of religious knowledge and upbringing, and he notices that this guy just, you know, some of the things that he says, they don't jibe with what he has read in the Bible or what the monk has taught him. But I keep putting that story down. I keep not writing it. I feel like there's still something missing. I need one more piece of the puzzle, I think, before I can continue on that. Or maybe I just need to double down and say this is the project that I'm working on next. And I'm not going to work on anything else until it's done. I wonder if that's what professional writers do. They've got all these other ideas. They've got these things that they want to write right now, but they can't because they've got a deadline on this or they have a commitment for this. This is the project they're working on right now, and that is going to take priority. We'll see. Going back to this story, that's not to say that Jaime Iglesias is a likable character. I just didn't hate him as much as I would have if he had been this religious hypocrite character that he initially was in my head. And who knows, the story might have been better if it had been a repellent bucket of crap. You know, like the story is a little bit like one of the old EC comics, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror kind of stories. Almost invariably, those were about bad people that got their comeuppance in a supernatural way. And I like stories like that. It's just, I don't know, I had him make this joke about the iron bars being in his suitcase. And I feel if he had been the scumbag that I had intended when I first started the story, he wouldn't have had any sense of humor at all. I don't know, maybe it makes the story better because he's more three-dimensional. As I've said before, with the exception of Donald Trump and Marshall Latham, no one is entirely good or entirely bad. And so maybe it makes the story better if, you know, there are a couple of things with him that you like. I don't know much. This is the story that I wrote. It's short. A part of me wants to sit down and flesh it out a little bit more and give a backstory to this guy and how he first discovered that he could trick people into believing what he wanted them to believe. But that's not really what it was about. I also didn't tell you this is a Dead and Breakfast story at the very, very beginning. And that was intentional. I wanted you to just read it, hear it. And if you were familiar with True Ghost Encounter, you'd be like, oh, I know where this story is going. There's no way to avoid that if I publish it. But I don't care. It's fun to write a story where it's dependent on another story. Somebody has to have read the other story to get this one. And then it's fun to write a story that the people who have read the other story will smile or be like, oh, hey, this is connected to that. But they don't have to. And I suppose, like in the Night Clerks case, I've written a story where if you have read the other stories in the series, then it's going to lessen your enjoyment of this one. Because you'll be like, okay, come on, come on, come on, get to the haunting already, get to the ghosts. So that's fun. That's interesting that I have these three different kinds of stories. I've talked before about ghosts. I'm afraid of ghosts. I don't know why ghosts upset me more than witches or aliens or Steve Buscemi or werewolves or, you know, the gang from the Warriors. But they do. The idea that, you know, they're a link to the other world, the afterlife, to or another world, to something less knowable, something that we don't understand, that, you know, people don't believe in, makes them scary. The scariest movie I've ever seen is The Grudge
scared the crap out of me, that movie. I'd say it was like the 2004. And I saw an interview with a bunch of dumb Americans that are... I was going to say they're remaking it, but it's a reboot, as they say, which is... It's an insulting term. It really is. It means dismiss everything that went before. And they were talking about how the idea of the ghost in The Grudge, you know, the Japanese ghost, doesn't work for American audiences, you know. So we came up with this idea that the curse, you know, it makes whatever you're personally afraid of come after you. And Americans don't believe in terrifying, white-faced, black-haired Japanese ghosts. So we've got something different in our movie. And I sort of shook my head, because the ghost in The Grudge was what made that movie so damn scary. The idea of the Japanese afterlife being so different than the, you know, Judeo-Christian afterlife was what made that movie so damn scary. The idea that somebody who had been wronged lived only to wrong others was super upsetting. That movie is so scary to me. And the concept of their ghosts was part of what contributed to my fear of that movie. The foreignness of it. I've talked before of that movie Mama that was so scary until I found out the motivations of the ghost or the creature. And then I was like, oh, well, now I kind of feel sorry for it. It's not as scary. Now that I know what it wants, I can deal with it. But the Grudge creature was something that had been harmed, and it wanted to harm others. It's a subtle distinction, but it's a distinction nonetheless. I think in an American recontextualization of that, you would have the ghost be someone who was harmed, and now they want to protect others from being harmed in the same way that they were. Batman, basically. You would turn that ghost into Batman, and we've seen it countless times in movies where there was a girl that was strangled, there was a girl that was murdered, there was a girl that was raped and beaten and died, and now she lives as a protector of girls like her. Now she is out there to drag Harrison Ford down to the bottom of the lake. And yeah, that's all well and good, but it's not as scary as something that the motivation doesn't match what happened. The ghost in The Grudge wanted to terrify. The idea of that stuff's not going to work for an American audience is wrong-headed and foolish, and I don't know that I need to see whatever they're calling the new Grudge. Sam Raimi is a producer, and he was a producer on the Sarah Michelle Gellar one, too, and he's a fine filmmaker. I really like Sam Raimi. I feel bad that he made that god-awful Oz prequel, and now he seems to be in director jail because, yeah, he was still a fairly young man, and I'm sure he had a bunch of really cool films in him, but they're all gone, and now I will forever remember how awful Mila Kunis was in Oz the Great and Powerful, and it taints everybody involved. But I guess we're not here to talk about their ghost movies, their ghost stories. We're here to talk about mine. And the fun of my concept is that you can have sexy ghosts, and you can have lonely ghosts, and you can have child ghosts, and you can have ghosts of comfort, and you can have old people ghosts that give wisdom. But you can also have vengeful ghosts, and you can have ghosts that want to harm. You can have ghosts, we don't know what they want, ghosts that are insane, you know. There's 1,000 ghosts that might show up at that bed and breakfast. And so any number of stories is possible. I'm not sure if I'm going to write another one of these soon or next year or, you know, 2 years from now. But I do like that I have another series, another group of stories that can join the Ben Parks stories. Hopefully you liked them and you would like to hear more. And if you've got ideas, as I've said, feel free to contact me here. You can contact me on Facebook. You can contact me by email. You can give me a pitch, but don't expect me to write it. If you've got ideas of where something would go and you would like to write something, I would be glad to give you notes. I would be glad to give you encouragement. And you probably have a home right here on the Rish Outcast. Even if you're not a writer, you have a home right here on the Rish Outcast. Feel free to email me, to comment, to support me on Patreon. I always need more people there. And let me know what you think. I've been Rish Outfield. This has been my new Halloween episode. I hope that you liked it. And I hope that you have a happy Halloween.
Que es un thriller, si lo es. Y nadie va a salvarte de la bestia cerca de ti. Que es un thriller, si lo es. Luchando por tu vida entre esta noche de daño, thriller.
Well, well, we've reached the end of another nigh unto interminable episode of the Rish Outcast. Now that the end has come, you may forget how painful it was, and that it was touch and go there for a while. I am here to remind you of what we've all suffered together. However, I am also here to remind you that the Outcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Download the file, listen to it, copy it, share it, and bring it up as a cautionary tale to frighten young ones into minding their manners. But do not change the files or attempt to sell them, or the worm will turn on you. And oh, that worm, how it hungers. Also hungry is Rish Outfield himself. He has an ever-dwindling Patreon support fund that helps motivate him to put out episodes and calms the beast raging inside him. You can donate per episode by visiting www.patreon.com/RishOutfield. Or you can tip him through PayPal via his blog. Thanks to Gino Moretto for his generous work on the logo. And lastly, none of us would have made it out alive if it weren't for the music of Kevin MacLeod, whose work also appears via a Creative Commons license and can be found at incompetech.com. Until next time, I have been Fake Sean Connery, and you have been warned.
Night creatures crawl in the dead, start to walk in their masquerade. Ay, 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 there's no escaping, they're just of the alien this time. This time is the end of the line.
I was working on the podcast late one night when my eyes beheld a ghastly sight walking through the door.
Okay, never mind. We'll do that later when I can sit down and concentrate on it. The punchline is
the chupacab. It was the chupacab. The chupacab. It nearly drove me mad. The chupacab.
I can't remember. Last night I came up with the whole damn song, and then the second verse, La Chupacab, the chorus sang it in Spanish.
Yo vi el Chupacab. Me hizo
Tan mad. I can't do it. I can't drive and concentrate on rhymes and try and translate into Spanish at the same time. So I did that with a night clerk. A couple of days later, I went to the library. The library is almost like the cabin in the woods for me on a micro scale. I go to the cabin because there's no distractions, because I'm alone, because there's no internet. I go there with the mindset, you are going to edit, or you are going to record, or you are going to make videos, or you are going to write. Or, on super productive days, like the one when I finished Night Clerk, all four of those things. The library is like a small version of that. You can use their computers for 2 hours. You get a two-hour appointment, and that's it. If you want to extend it past that, then you have to pay them, which is fine. They're super generous. I keep having late fees when I return books or videos, or audiobooks are the worst because it takes me forever to finish an audiobook. And I think about, oh gosh, you know, it cost me $1.80 in late fees on this audiobook. And I think, but back in the Blockbuster Video or Hollywood Video days, you would have late fees way higher than that. I would have $7 or $8 late fees as a matter of course. I can't remember what the cutoff was, but once you'd reached like a $20 late fee or $10 late fee, it might have been $10, they wouldn't let you rent anything until you paid off the late fees. And so I would usually just go to another Blockbuster or Hollywood Video and be like, okay, that's this one now. In those days, I was renting a ton of horror movies. I had a website where we would review horror movies, and it brought me joy. I think about it sometimes, and I feel a little bit of that joy. And it's a shame that that went away. But it did. With the library, they charge you 10 cents a day for late fees. And that's ludicrously small. So basically, I go to the library and I've got a 2 hour appointment on this computer. Many times I will write. I'll say, okay, I'm forcing myself to write X number of words, or until so and so time, or until the appointment runs out. And I got the night clerk out and started formatting it, you know, putting in the tabs where you're supposed to. There was a character, I didn't know their name, and so I just had a line for their name. I had to fix that. But as I started formatting it, I realized just how long Night Clerk is. And I thought, oh, okay, for sure this is going to be two episodes, because it's a, you know, maybe not a novella, it's a whatever, in between a short story and a novella. And I knew that, okay, well, it's going to be a little bit more work to sit down and record this thing. I might not even get the whole thing done in a day, and then I'm going to have to edit it. Then I'm going to have to record a second episode for Night Clerk. Then I'm going to have to edit that episode. And then the next week I went to the cabin, and my laptop died. It died at about 8 or 8:30 p.m. And I was just like, oh no, what can I do now? I came up here to edit. I also brought some DVDs from the library that I was going to watch on my laptop when I got sick of editing. And then, yeah, my third option was to write, but what was I going to do? Open a notebook and write in it? And see, that's what I should have done. But instead, I got the library book that I from my backpack, and I finished that, and I started a second book. I think I read 50, 60 pages in that. And I was like, oh, shoot, what do I do now? Well, I guess I'll go to sleep. So I went to sleep, and because I went to sleep early, I got up early. And I was supposed to have, you know, the whole day. I had like 10 or 12 or 14 hours left at the cabin, because I go up on a Thursday afternoon and come back on a Friday, usually 5 or 6 p.m. I just packed everything up, got back in the car, and came home, because without my laptop, I was helpless. And then I thought about, you know, the laptop is where I do my editing. Without a laptop, what can I do? Oh my gosh, this is going to be a long, long story. Folks, this is my outtake, then.
Before the kid could declare anything she might do was more than all right. Before the kid could declare anything she might do. Before the kid could declare anything she might do was more than all right. Before the kid could declare anything she might do was more than all right. Iglesias cleared his throat. The audience applauded again, this time unbidden. The episode was going to be a viewer favorite. The end.
Es un thriller, cerca chalupa, y me gusta chalupa, si en toda día.